Baby Lawrence tap dancing to Charlie Parker's Moose the Mooch in a recording that also featured Bobby Jasper and Roland Hanna. Both the Baby Lawrence tunes that we opened the show with today are from an album on the Classic Jazz record label called Baby Lawrence, the world's premier tap dancer. Well, in June on Fresh Air, we were joined by Philadelphia-based writer David Slavitt. David Slavitt has written novels, volumes of poetry, and film criticism under his own name. But for the mildly salacious stuff, as he calls it, he invented a pen name. That name is Henry Sutton. It was under the Henry Sutton name that books like The Exhibitionist, The Voyeur, and The Sacrifice have been written. The persona of a pseudonym is frequently kept well hidden by an author, but today my guest is the pseudonymous Henry Sutton. By way of introduction, I'd like to play an excerpt from the interview that I recorded in June on Fresh Air when my guest was David Slavitt. In this short flashback sequence, you will hear me introduce David Slavitt, and then you'll hear David Slavitt explain the existence of Henry Sutton. In the studio with me now is poet and novelist David Slavitt. David Slavitt also has a pseudonym, which is Henry Sutton, and he has written what he calls mildly salacious books under that name, books like The Exhibitionist and The Voyeur. In 1967, David Slavitt had two first novels, one published under each name. In 1978, two novels were published, one under each name. In all, there are 8 volumes of poetry, 7 novels under the name Slavitt, and 6 novels under his pseudonym. There is also a textbook that he published in 1976 called Understanding Social Life. David Slavitt is a graduate of Yale and Columbia. From 1958 to 65, he was an associate editor at Newsweek, where he was the film critic. He's presently, in addition to writing, teaching creative writing at Temple University Center City, and he's teaching a course in popular literature at Temple Sugarloaf. David Slavitt lives in Philadelphia. His new novel, under his own name, is called Joe Stern. Again, Joe Stern is the name of the novel, not a third name that David Slavitt uses. The book is about a woman who writes books, which, with flashy publicity, become bestsellers. The woman is not unlike Jacqueline Suzanne. The story of Joe Stern takes place amidst much intrigue in the publishing world. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Well, thank you. Nice to be here, Terry.
Nice to have you here. Let's start off with your other name before we get to your real name. Why do you write with different names? Why is some of your work Henry Sutton and other of your work David Slavitt?
Well, I wonder. Originally, the theory was that it would be nice to make some kind of distinction between the two kinds of work and the two kinds of audiences, because they really have different audiences. And when Longines makes a cheap watch for wide sale, they call it a Whitnauer. And there's a commercial tradition for that, which is quite well established in Western capitalismo. The other literary way of doing it, which Graham Greene had tried, failed, clearly. He used to write an entertainment on Istanbul Train or whatever that was. And then graduate students would spend enormous amounts of time and typewriter paper trying to prove that the entertainments were really more serious than the heart of the matter or the end of the affair. So that he finally gave it up, and it just made no sense. And I thought that, well, as you said, both of these books, The Exhibitionist and one you've never heard of called Rochelle or Virtue Rewarded, were coming out within a month of each other. And the way things are in the book trade, I figured that it was less likely that bookstores would order both books if they were under the same name. They would probably limit themselves to the one that had the enormous advertising and publicity budget. And so I had to protect one.
Book dealers don't know about this. They're never.
Oh, they found out later.
Uh-huh.
They found. I mean, there was a big thing about it in Life, and I was on all these talk shows and. I was revealed at an opportune moment. But partly to protect the other book and partly because it seemed reasonable to do, I tried the two different names. And in a way, it's partially backfired, I think. Reviewers now have the feeling when a Henry Sutton book comes in that this is, he is slumming and this is schlock. And when a David Slavitt book comes in, ah, this is highbrow, low revenue stuff. We can ignore it. It will sell 9 copies. So, I am hoist by my own petard, whatever a petard is.
What we've just heard was recorded on Fresh Air in June, on June 29th, when my guest was David Slavitt. Now, you've just heard writer David Slavitt speak about why he writes some books under the pen name of Henry Sutton. In the studio with me now, making one of his very rare media appearances, is Henry Sutton. Now, Henry Sutton has a new book. The ones that made his name famous, you will recall, were The Exhibitionist and The Voyeur. This new novel is a novel of the occult, called The Sacrifice, that's published by Grosset and Dunlap. Henry Sutton, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Do you think that David Slavitt, in the excerpt that we just heard from the June Fresh Air interview, was being a little overly academic about the, in his explanation of the existence of Henry Sutton?
Well, he always is. That's his main trouble. His explanation of my existence is fairly easy. I support him. My explanation of his existence is a little harder to do because fiction is a public art. It's a middle-class art. The growth of the novel came from the Indus Rev and the Agric Rev and all these people suddenly having time to read books and not being patrons of the theater or readers of poetry. So the novel is a great middle-class democratic form. And if you're successful at it and entertain a lot of people, you do well. And if you don't, then you can always fall back on that plaintive yawp about how I'm just too good for them. And I don't buy any of that. I mean, if he wants to have this hobby and write little books, that's okay.
How much do you enjoy writing the novels that you write, novels like The Sacrifice and The Exhibitionist, The Voyeur?
Oh, I like it. If I didn't like it, I couldn't do it. You have to, I think Robert Frost once said, no fun for the writer, no fun for the reader. And it tells. Most of the time I sit there watching this movie unroll in my head, and I just write down what the characters say and describe what they do. I came to this actually from having been a. Well, this now because the pronouns now get hard. We came to this from once having been the Newsweek movie critic, where we used to watch 700 movies a year. And there are two results. One is that you begin to hear background music in your regular daily life, which begins to be wonderful. And the other thing is that. We were able to notice what everybody notices anyway, that there are some movies that are intellectually shabby, Disney movies maybe, but that when the dog comes bounding across the lawn, having traversed the entirety of Canada, you feel the little tears springing hot to your eyes, and yeah, it was good. And there are good bad movies, and similarly there are good bad books. A bad book simply being a book that is not presently being taught in some college or university.
Well, one of the differences between your books as Henry Sutton and David Slavitt's books is that Henry Sutton's books at times have made it to the bestseller list, and David Slavitt's, I believe, have not.
Well, now, that's because I pay attention to what the public taste is, and I'm a kind of democratic good guy, and he's something of a snob.
Well, when David Slavitt was here on the show in Fresh Air in June, he had a few words to say about the way the public's taste defines what books become popular.
If the great American novels are Valley of the Dolls, Jaws, The Godfather, and Love Story, what the hell am I doing in this business?
Well,
to whom am I writing?
I'm going to.
I mean, Vox Clamantis and Deserto is all right, but this is a jungle. This is a pit. Well, what is there to say to that? Those highbrow writers always kvetch and complain. Among the books he mentioned, The Godfather is actually pretty good. You know, it's a great read, which is what people say if they want to be Tony and smart and yet admit that they had a good time reading a book that everybody else read. There are all kinds of precious writers for whom there is a cult audience, and that's okay. But there are certain principles of democratic life and profit motive capitalism that are quite authentic and legitimate, go right across the board. And I'm happy when my sales are up because it means that a lot of people are buying the books and presumably reading them.
When the Exhibitionist and the Voyeur were first were written and they became very popular, you had described them as being books that were not really dirty, not pornographic, but, you know, had sexual encounters that never really got very explicit. Has Henry Sutton, have you been writing since that time things that are more sexually explicit?
Well, as Henry Sutton, no. They were explicit enough. The point that you have to remember is that The Exhibitionist came out in 1967 and The Voyeur came out in 68 or 69. I can't quite remember, but one of those years. And in sexual mores and permissiveness, the decade and indeed even the year is terribly important. You have to go back to the late 60s and remember how there were school boards that were meeting to purge their libraries of such things as Catcher in the Rye, because it had a famous Anglo-Saxon word in it, which I think Holden Caulfield sees on a wall and makes him distressed. It wasn't prurient or suggestive or anything like that. And the tastes and the attitudes have changed drastically from 67 to now for a couple of reasons, I think. One is that there are ratings in the movies. And if you have small towns where the principal, the faculty of the high school, the school board, and the entire student body, they all see each other in one room at an R movie, then it is very difficult to meet the following Wednesday and worry a lot about Holden Caulfield. So that in that way it's eased up legitimately. And another thing that, in a sort of theoretical way, I favor, is that there are now porn shops, hardcore porn shops, all over the country in any town of 50,000 or larger. This means that simply to be salacious is no longer possible. I mean, you can't shock the way you can't be just a little bit more shocking than everybody else has been and make a big dollar that way. That was never, I think, the reason for the success of those books, although it didn't hurt them any. I mean, you know, each one was a whopping good yarn. But there was sex in them. What Yeats once said, I think, was where I took my cue here. And he said, only, you know, what else is a serious person interested in besides sex and death? Sex having been pretty much played into the ground, I went on to death. And the occult.
Yeah, and that's interesting because that's one of the big movie trends now, too, is occult films.
Sure. You see them...
like Damien and Omen 2, or Damien 2, or Damien Omen 2, whichever it is. And
Damien
all the
is
spin-offs
Omen 2,
from the
whatever that is. Sure, all that. And I think both those and disaster movies. The Towering Inferno, Avalanche, The Swarm, The Rabid Voles, that hasn't been made yet, but I'm waiting, and I may not have to wait long. All of these things, I think, are suggestive of a couple of really disturbing tendencies in society now. The only way I can account for the success of most of them is to suppose that most people have the feeling that they've lost control of their lives, and that the society is no longer responsive to their wishes, that what they want, what they intend, what they desire makes no difference, and therefore they're passive victims. And they are passive victims either of huge forces like tidal waves, earthquakes, typhoons, plane crashes, or of occult forces which have been long buried under the veneer of the Enlightenment and rationalism. And if we no longer believe in the Enlightenment and rationalism, then we go back to primitivo spookiness, which is fine to work with if you're an entertainer, because there are all kinds of wonderful twists and turns that is left to play on with those limp old cards.
The book that you've most recently written, The Sacrifice, is a book of the occult.
Yeah.
And I think that probably the occult has been around as a major topic for books and movies than the disaster epic has, and that there's maybe like more time-honored devices that one must use when writing a book of the occult.
Well, it has a longer literary history, as you say, and for that reason it's more fun to play with, because there are more things to click off of and make cushion shots from.
One of the first things that I learned about the main character, Roger Braithwaite in the book, is that he's an associate professor of classics. And I howled when I saw that. It seemed just right. He has to be an associate professor of classics. And if he encounters cryptic texts at any point, I mean, he'll know the entire history of this type of text and will be able to be in touch both with these times and with historical times and be able to mediate between the two and
there were several
esoteric information.
His existence is the result of a couple of observations which anybody could have made. One is that in the traditional Gothic novel or horror novel, you start off in a secure surrounding, and then from there you go off into the unknown, frightening territory. And in many of them, one particularly I had always admired, came out 15, 20 years ago, called Doctors Wear Scarlet by Simon Raven, who wrote the screenplay of the Palliser series, and who's a pretty good, popular, decadent novelist. I mean, he tries to be decadent and fails, which is probably why he's popular. The security of the beginning is in some common room of some Cambridge college, which is where the title comes from. And I just translated that. And there must be 20 movies that I can remember where two guys are sitting around in club chairs somewhere in London or Oxford or Cambridge, and one of them is saying to the other, "Lycanthropy, sir, in this day and age, lycanthropy, nonsense." And then outside the window, there's somebody turning into a wolf. terrific, great. But I took the Oxford and Cambridge thing and I put it in New Haven, which is as close as we have to that kind of setting. And pleasant to work with because it's silly. I mean, there's a lot of Yale background which is ludicrous and risible. I noticed some yesterday. I drove my daughter up to start there, and I had not realized that there is a whole wall that has gargoyles all over it of the heads of bulldogs. I just missed that 25 years ago. So that was one part of it. The other part of it is that who is the guy in all of those sanctions, the Iger sanction, the Liu sanction, the whatever? He is an art professor. And the idea there is your oxymoronic reversal, where you have somebody who is, he's an art expert and history of art professor somewhere. And it turns out that he's rugged and tough.
Right. And he's using Jaws, too, isn't it?
Sure. So that you have the puffball who turns out to be inside made of tungsten steel. And this is yet one other change on the typical Lou Grant or Telly Savalas character, who is gruff and tough, but he eats lollipops, or he's, he has candy in his desk, he's nice to little children, the tough but tender.
So this is an opportunity for the academes to show their mettle.
Sure. And it is, as a matter of fact, true that many of the guys in the OSS and the coding departments in cryptoanalysis during World War II were classics professors from Yale and Harvard, because they were good at that. So between or among all of those things, I suddenly had a character at Yale who was going to find some manuscript with some deadly question in it. And the question was, the heart of the book was a truly stupid, wonderful question that I had figured out, which was, not a new question, if you could go out onto Market Street, find somebody passing at random and kill them and get away with it, and if you were assured that the number of years that they had left to live would be added on to your own, would you do it? Well, probably not, but on the other hand, you would think about it some, especially if you were along in years. And it's a kind of wonderful question. I think somewhere in the book I retell briefly the grim fairy tale of the Godfather Death, which is a real grim fairy tale. And the epigraph is from Alcestis. And that whole notion of, can you hire somebody to die for you? Can you borrow time?
And then you also introduce the whole moral question, is it worth taking someone's life if that person is going to amount to nothing in this world, add nothing to his community or the society at large? And if you took those years, added onto your life, and you are smart and intelligent and can add wonderful things to the academic community and the neighborhood, then would it be worth that exchange?
Oh, sure. The whole business of actuarial figuring, of the kind that insurance companies and the Defense Department do all the time, turning each one of us, I mean, each one of us is a universe, and they forget this, and they just turn us into numbers. And as soon as you do that, you lead yourself open to this kind of double-entry bookkeeping. The other underlying paranoid fancy in here, which I assume is widespread, and I'm banking heavy on that, is the notion that I think Scott Fitzgerald is the one who's supposed to have enunciated most succinctly about the rich are different from us. And the only thing that makes the rich like us is that they're going to die too. So that if you take that last similarity out so that they could buy out of immediate mortality, then they really are different from us. And the last propping that prevents, I suppose, revolution, people stoning Rockefellers and Mellons, is the notion that they are part of the human condition. If they weren't, then how horrible. And so it's playing with those.
And I think that in any book of the occult or in any book about werewolves or strange creations like monsters being made in scientists' laboratory, that there usually aren't many women in a book like that or in a movie like that, but there's usually one who's both intelligent and attractive and can run quick, but usually wears high heels, so can't run
yes.
too quickly and has
That's
gotten
right.
at the end. But anyway, she's like the love interest of one of the main characters.
The Lee Remick figure in The Omen.
Uh-huh.
Sure.
Now, did you, like, consciously work with that as a device? I mean, did you sit down and say to yourself, now, there's got to be a love interest in this book. There's got to be a smart but beautiful woman in the book. Where should I fit her in? What should her connection be?
Well, I don't suppose I ever even raised the question of whether there shouldn't be. It just seemed natural that there would, for a couple of reasons. It helps to humanize the hero if he has an emotional life. And if he's an associate professor of classics and you're trying to suggest that he's actually, decent, healthy, normal, red-blooded American fella underneath, it had better be a woman. That's useful for that. And it also allows him to talk to somebody and then to worry about whether he can trust her, because there's one point in the course of, I mean, it turns essentially into a chase, which, I mean, I love chases. Chases, if they are done well, can be wonderful. I think television has hurt us because they just have cars hurtling around because those are so visually easy to do. But the chase where you are not sure whom you can trust and upon whom you can rely and who's been turned and who hasn't, this is a wonderful kind of psychological toy to play with, and the relationship about which you would feel most upset if you had the feeling that it was infected would be a sexual connection. So that's in there. It's You know, a lot of this is just setups and payoffs. And
what do you mean?
I mean that most popular fiction, most entertainment, most movies, you set something up and then you pay it off 40 pages later, or 70 pages later, or 120 pages later. And it is from the setting up and the paying off of whatever. You know, in any play that has a gun hanging over the mantle, when the curtain goes up, you expect and you're entitled to see the gun go off before the third act curtain falls. So that's a setup and a payoff. And the feeling of order that one has in fiction. Because all fiction maintains the sublime fiction, the supreme fiction, as Wallace Stevens would have said, is that the world makes sense. Because if the world doesn't make sense, you can't write novels. Because you could kill off all your characters on page 4 and talk about Moss. That might be philosophically a true thing to do, but most people don't think about life that way, and those are the kinds of audiences that Slavitt enjoys, or suffers, or whatever. So the middle-class notion that the world is fundamentally reasonable is basic to all novels. Poetry doesn't require them so much, but novels assume this. And Isaac Singer once was asked about, he was giving a lecture about belief in God and the notion that there is a purpose to the universe and how this enables fiction. And some graduate student asked him at the end of this thing, Mr. Singer, you said that there was a purpose to the universe. Could you tell us what this is? And he said, if I could answer that question, I would be enjoying a considerably wider audience than I am enjoying here tonight. But just the idea that there is a shape is enough.
Well, you know, the question of is there order in the universe and all this is actually a question that's introduced in a book like The Sacrifice. It's the question that the main character always has to answer, because suddenly the impossible, i.e. Killing someone and getting the remaining years of their life added onto your own, which is impossible, right? We would think.
Sure.
Becomes possible, but he doesn't know if he's going mad, right? You never know when this is introduced to a story, well, if you're losing your mind or if you're really on to something
just
diabolical.
Just figured out this minute, I mean, while you ask the question, that what distinguishes the horror novel from other kinds of novels is that other kinds of novels make the claim, more or less convincingly, that there is order to the universe. The horror novel suggests that there may be too much order to the universe and that it is in some way suffocating or terrifying or threatening, and that we are caught untrapped in this exquisite web.
And that the order is being created by these very demonic aliens,
Yes.
One sort or another,
sure.
Who are either long dead or from another planet. Or
long dead, but nevertheless driving around in old cars.
No, it's pretty standard in movies, anyways, monster movies and creature movies and movies of the occult, that the force that's causing all this terror may or may not be finally stamped out at the end. There's frequently a question left hanging in a place like Damien, The Omen, that makes the possibility for a second film, a sequel, to come along.
Yes.
But in earlier films... frequently
Costello meet Frankenstein.
Yeah, Frankenstein, sure. Or the creatures who have landed, before they have a chance to destroy the Earth, go back to their planet, and someone looks at the skies and says, they may be back.
Yes,
and the
yes.
Credits roll. But in your novel, I hope I'm not giving anything away that anyone who's listening will object to me giving away, but in the end, the demonic forces are thriving, and the heroes are eaten by dogs.
Yes. Better than that, the manuscript, which has been reposing all these years and causing such terrible problems at the Sterling Library at Yale, is being given to the Widener Library at Harvard, and it's their problem, and they can worry about it. I liked having them eaten by dogs, because I've always been afraid of large dogs. I mean, anything bigger than a poodle is menacing. All of those stories about, you know, barking dogs don't bite. I know this, but does a dog know it? And they're fearsome creatures. The reason I write probably is that I'm afraid of the big dogs that are guarding the gas station, so I can't knock them off. So I sit there at the typewriter with my door bolted and imagine it.
Is it highly unusual, though, for the two heroic people in the book, the two main characters, to be completely destroyed by these horrible forces that have been conspiring against them from page one?
In horror novels, no. or in horror movies. I mean, in the original Damien, I mean, the one with Lee Remick and...
Gregory Peck.
Both of them die.
Yes, they do, don't they?
And then there is the kid, and then he comes back, and there's Lee Grant and whoever the Gregory Peck, the cheaper Gregory Peck type was. I can't remember. Holden?
I don't know. I didn't see the second.
I didn't see it either. But if you have the dark force that's still going, the dark force is really your hero. And these are people who are interesting. I mean, they're interesting as human beings. They are paracletes. They suffer for us. And the final paranoid fear is that only you will be aware of what the danger is, and that it will wipe you out, and you will not have been able to tell anybody. And so it's, I mean, you have to be, you have to daydream effectively. That is just, effectively simply means you have to remember what the direction of the daydream was and assume that everybody else's daydreams go in fairly much the same directions as yours do. We're all worried about the same things and disturbed by the same things and having the same feelings of helplessness. So you play on that.
On the dust jacket for the book The Sacrifice, it's written, "The forces at work in this tale are so diabolical that you should not read it away from the company of others," which is a fantastic statement. Have you gotten any response from anyone saying, "Listen, your book really terrified me. I haven't slept for weeks. Even the sedatives won't knock me out because I live in fear upon the completion of your book"? Would that be a success tale?
The most successful testimonial of that kind I've gotten was from my mother, who is not allowing my father to read it because she thinks it would frighten him.
About what kind of parent he's been?
No. I mean that the book would frighten him.
No, because sometimes you wonder, like, when someone close to you writes a book like that filled with all kinds of strange demonic things, like, where did they get it from? What sent their mind wandering in such strange and dark directions?
Oh, well, that was easy. When I grew up in White Plains, which was absolutely the capital of boredom. I mean, it's like Australia, reduced to one small town and stuck in Westchester. The only interesting thing in White Plains was that... Percy Grainger used to live there, and he would walk around in the wintertime in sneakers. And in the 40s, this was considered the most bizarre behavior that was conceivable to the mind of man. And he would also occasionally give concerts in New York, and he would walk from White Plains to Manhattan, which is 25 miles, and through the Bronx. So long and dangerous. And if you live in a place that dull... then you have a great deal of time to spend looking out of the window, imagining beasts and creatures in the oak tree that are going to get you, and at least make it interesting to be here. So that's just perfectly.
Mother has asked your father to not read the book.
No. My mother has asked me whether she should let him read the book.
Mm-hmm. What did you say?
And I said I don't know. Didn't scare me, but on the other hand, I always knew it was going to happen. Sure, let him read it.
What are some of your favorite, creature or science fiction or, outer space, demonic forces?
Well, my all-time favorite is a movie which occurs occasionally on the Late, Late, Late Show, like 2, 3 in the morning on channels with very high numbers, called Frankenstein Meets the Space Monster, which is a low-budget movie that a couple of friends of mine wrote, George Garrett, the novelist, and Richard Dillard, the poet. Garrett writes poems, too. And this was one of those exploitation movies that was made for a couple of $100,000 to play in drive-ins. And it's an underground classic of immense proportions because it's so silly. The monster has hot dogs as teeth sticking out of his mouth. And I mean, it looks really bizarre. And because they were typing this movie very fast, it was written over a weekend. I mean, one 72-hour stretch. Writing out Frankenstein on the typewriter took a great deal of time and work. So they abbreviated it to Frank. And there is a certain point in the movie at which people start referring to the monster as Frank. And nobody notices. And it's I like that for private and quirky reasons. I rather like Rosemary's Baby. Not because... because I think I figured it out. When that first came out, I tried to figure why this was frightening and why it was so enormously successful. and it didn't really make any sense. The world is not full of lapsed Catholics in enough numbers to account for that kind of box office. And then I figured that any woman who has either been pregnant or has seriously thought about it realizes that her body is being invaded by an alien creature. And once you have an alien creature invading your body, once you've figured it out and expressed it that way, from there on it's just carpentry. And of course it's the devil, and of course it's some gloomy, preposterous apartment house in New York. The other thing about horror books that's interesting is that while they are on the surface, supremely silly, the good ones have a metaphorical truth, or they touch a fear or an aspiration or a dread, something that is true and has a legitimacy. And I like that one. I thought that some of the effects in The Omen were pretty good.
Mm-hmm. You know, another thing about Rosemary's Baby, mm-hmm. maybe that helped make it so popular, was its combining of sex and the demon, because the demon literally enters her.
Oh, sure.
And that's if you read any books about the devil, you'll see that that's frequently an initiation ritual.
Yes.
That's a pretty pivotal scene in the book.
There are other myths about the devil that should have been included. There was a late Renaissance belief that it came in with the beginning of virtuoso violin playing, really, that nobody could do this. This is beyond human capabilities. Therefore, anybody who could play the violin that well had to be a creature of the devil, had to have sold his soul in exchange for such talent. And there is, I think, a wonderful Tartini piece called The Devil's Trill, which invokes that superstition. And it would have been swell in Rosemary's Baby if, among all the sex scenes, there had been one scene where the devil in repose is standing there playing the violin. Just loony, but give him another aspect of his character.
That's becoming a kind of campy thing in the whole horror trade, isn't it? That whole combination of sexuality and demonhood. Because Dracula, for instance, always had that implicit sexuality, a very handsome, dapper member of the nobility with large teeth biting women's necks. And now that's really being
Middle European, Eastern European accent. Ha ha, I never drink wine, Mr. Enfield. Yeah. I wish I could do that better. I think the notion of evil in the abstract is, like any abstraction, thin. You want to body it however you can. And because we are all brought up, the horror, the great age of horror, really begins about middle Victorian. Before that, it's silly. It starts, let us say, with Frankenstein in 1816, that was. But this is the beginning of the Victorian age. That's still technically the Regency, and then there's George IV or whoever he was, but it blossomed and took root in... it took root and then it blossomed, let's be reasonable, in Victorian times, so that the whole notion of pudeur and shame and feeling of dirty, nasty about sex became immediately the locus of all the unleashed dark forces. And it's curious that in a society as ostensibly as permissive as ours, with X-rated films and porno shops all over, that there is still this notion of the equation of sex and evil. And I think most of that is a literary heritage rather than a perceived response to how things are in the world now.
I sometimes think that both are really interesting to people who go see movies and buy books. For instance, that you've gone from the exhibitionist and the voyeur, whose titles at least are very sexual in meaning, to something like The Sacrifice, which is obviously the occult and isn't really filled with sex by any means. But chances are maybe they will be bought by similar people for different reasons, but there is that appeal in both of them that make things like that popular.
sure. You know, Yeats was right. Sex and death is what we are all interested in.
That's where we started, isn't it? Yeah.
And I guess the other thing is evil. And if you're unhappy, it's either your fault or it's the world's fault. And if it's the world's fault, then that's evil. And there are some kinds of things out of which you cannot be simply, you know, readjusted. So that, you know, it's out there.
The New York Times has been on strike for about a month now, I think. Has that affected you at all? And I don't know if they had intentions to review The Sacrifice or not.
I think they did, and whether they will when they come back, I have no idea. It had a quite favorable review in the Bulletin a couple of weeks ago. But, you know, how many people in New York who can't get the Times are reading the Bulletin? There are, and how much weight that carries, I just don't know.
Is that hurtful to you, do you think?
Yes. Yes. It would be an excuse for Slavitt. To me, it is an just a positive pain. I figure it will cost me somewhere between $15,000 and $25,000.
Really?
But that's okay. You know, I'm going to write another one.
Will you be writing pornography in the future?
I have been thinking about that. I've been thinking, the idea of writing a... Now that there is enough pornography around so that it is established as a literary genre, which means that you can play with it. To do simply a straight porno would be fairly dull. I mean, everybody has about 9 fantasies, and you get through those, and you're only on page 45, and where do you get from there to the end of the book? But pornography as a literary construction with the same rules and the same confines as, say, a Western or a detective novel, that can be fun to play with. And my other notion is that it would be indeed amusing to don yet a new persona and be female. Because if a man writes a dirty book, it's either got to be Lolita or it's just another piece of garbage. But if a woman does it, then it's sincere and brave. And all of those women like Erica Jong and Gail Green and who else, who've been imitating Philip Roth, have been getting vast numbers of points for doing something that I think is mildly amusing but not all that pioneering. So for me to become, at least to have a name which is transvestite, would be, see how that goes.
The big question... The only question I know of in pornographic books as to the real gender of one of the authors is Pauline Reage, who is the name attributed to the story of O.
Yes, yes.
And I've heard it said a lot that Pauline Reage is probably the pen name for a person who's probably a man and used a woman's name for reasons similar to what you're describing.
Well, that's possible. It's also possible that Pauline Reage is one of the champion butch characters of France. It's a strange series of fantasies. Made a very stylish softcore film where the costumes were really quite remarkable. but to do with the porno genre what say Thomas Berger did with the Western when he did Little Big Man, you know, kind of turned it on his head to make it essentially a filthy Jane Austen, that would be that might be amusing.
Mm-hmm. Well, Henry Sutton, before you leave, you must tell us what David Slavitt is up to nowadays.
Oh, well, poor kid. Slavitt has a book of poems, believe it or not, coming out from Louisiana State University Press, from which, if he's really lucky, he stands to make $58.41. That includes paperback. And... And he will be going, I think, to Arkansas in January to be the Arkansas Traveler, he tells me. And I said, what's that? And he said, we're skitsy a little sometimes. He said that, it's great. You go to Little Rock, Fayetteville, Magnolia, and Jonesboro. Once, you know, you do 4 places in 4 nights and you get paid a whole $1,000. And I said, Jonesboro? And he said, yeah. And I said, you're welcome to it. So he's going to go to Arkansas. He's going to read his poems, and I wish him well.
Well, I wish him well, too. I've been speaking with Henry Sutton, who is a Philadelphia-based writer, who is the author of a new book called The Sacrifice, which is a novel of the occult published by Grosset Dunlap. Henry Sutton is also the author of books like The Exhibitionist and The Voyeur. Henry Sutton, I also may add, is the pseudonym, the pen name, of David Slavitt, who has written many novels and many volumes of verse, is also a former film critic for Newsweek. And Henry Sutton, David Slavitt, thank you very much for being here this afternoon. I've enjoyed it greatly.
Well, we've had a wonderful time, yes. And thank you.
This is Fresh Air. You're listening to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia.